The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect those of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
And we're back here and analyze this. We're going to do some programming. Next thing, we're going to call the National Weather Service right after that so they could give us an update as to what to expect in the middle of the week, heading towards the weekend. We got the PBS News Hour that starts at 7 p.m. And then at 8 p.m., this is on Channel 12 tonight, by the way. Nature, explore the variety of activity, human and natural, that occurs on the slopes of active volcanoes. So that's from 8 to 9 p.m. And then at 9 p.m., investigate one of the most powerful volcanic eruptions in recorded history. And then at 10 p.m., examine the evidence that melting soil in the Arctic is releasing vast amounts of methane. Right? And then that's NOVA. That's two editions of NOVA back-to-back from 9 to 11. Right? 2 one-hour editions, 9 to 10 and 10 to 11. And then POV point of view. Follow a defiant movement led by women of color as they fight for a truly reflective democracy. Okay? So we got the News Hour at 7, Nature at 8, two editions of NOVA at 9 and 10, and then POV at 11. Of course, I'm a pouring company coming out of midnight tonight because of the two editions of NOVA. So what we're going to do is we're going to call the weather service so they could let us know if this beautiful weather that we got here is going to remain the same. And then we'll see what we do from there, because it looks like Mr. Ursuluk is not going to be available this morning. So we'll be back. Hopefully we get the weather service on so they can let us know what's going on there as well. But like I was saying, yeah, go ahead. No answer? Got the phone busy. Error message? Okay. Yeah, so. Work on that. I'm going to try to reach out to my partner here. I want to ask him a question. Because we had some legal runners. Dwayne Henry actually is in transit this morning, heading out the way. I want to see if I could reach out to my partner. And hopefully, we still ain't getting no answer from the weather service. Like I was saying, we had four elections last night. Because the primaries are ramping up. They call it Super Tuesday too, but they don't really compare to. Super Tuesday last week when we had 15 states and a territory. I believe it was American Samoa that Jason Palmer won on the Democratic side. That's the one defeat that the president, the incumbent president on the Democratic side, has suffered so far. But yesterday, Georgia had a primary, and that's a state that people are looking at because it is now a purple state, or it has been at least for the last two election cycles. Both Trump and Biden were successful. But what they're looking at in terms of trying to forecast how we can impact the election down the road, which is still 7.5 months away, you know, almost close to 8 months, is on the Democratic side, the percentage of Democratic voters, because he's running practically unopposed with Dean Phillips suspending his campaign last week and Marianne Williamson not knowing what she's doing, suspending her campaign and then jumping in after the uncommitted vote in Michigan. So they were looking at the percentage numbers on the Democratic side. And then they were also looking on the Republican side, the percentage of Republicans who were opposed to Trump. So based on the data, because Georgia was a critical state in 2020, where President Biden pulled off what some would seem as an upset, because the Georgia hadn't gone blue in a lot of years, right? He won that state by about 10 or 11,000, right? I'm going to pull up the numbers here. Presidential election, bam, bam, bam. Georgia. So here's the results from yesterday in Georgia, right? On the Republican side, Donald Trump, 84.5%, 496,560 with greater than 95% reporting, right? Nikki Haley, 77,774, 13.2%, and Ron DeSantis, he actually got 7,441. So you know, if DeSantis drop out from back in January when he got beat up in Iowa, and he's still getting 7,000 votes. So looking at the networks, they were saying, look, if you got a margin in 2020 of 10,000 votes, and where Trump lost to Biden, and you're still seeing, in this case, 85,000 Republicans or folks who voted in the Republican primary voting for someone other than Trump, then that means numerically still has some work to do. Now, all these people might come home on the Republican side come November. There's still a long way to go. You know what I'm saying? But that's a significant number, right? Now, on the Democratic side, you had less turnout for obvious reasons, because it's pretty much a done deal who's going to be the Democratic nominee. So you had 288,866 total votes, right? President Biden got 95.2%, 274,967. Marianne Williamson got 8,644, and Dean Phillips got 5,255. 3% and 1.8% respectively, right? And that gets you to the 100%, right? When you add the 95.2 to that combined 4.8%, right? So from a percentage standpoint, Biden has to like that, at least within the Democratic voting apparatus, 19 out of every 20 voted for him. I mean, you could have some protest vote and some uncommitted, right? Because, you know, there's certain things about the way the country running that some might have a problem with. 19 out of 20 is good. His issue, though, is enthusiasm, because you had 288,866 Democrats, and you had Democrats who voted, or those who voted, because I believe it's an open primary, those who voted in the Democratic side. Then you had almost 300,000 more participating in the Republican primary. So clearly, you know, the party that is not in control, enthusiasm is going to be higher. So that's something to be concerned about. Even though, from a percentage standpoint, 10% more Democrats voted for Biden than Republicans voted for Trump, you had, 496 and 274, 220,000 more people voting for Trump yesterday in the Republican primary. That's why percentage is one thing, but you always hear them talking about turnout, because it's all about turnout. You know what I'm saying? So that was in Georgia. Out in the West, you had Washington, right? And typically, you also had Mississippi, but Mississippi is 100% red. There's no way Biden gonna win Mississippi. That's just a done deal, right? Washington, same thing. They typically vote blue out there. And Donald Trump got 74.2% of the vote, 80% of the votes have been counted at this point. And Nikki Haley got 21.7%. So you had that in intra-party protests, right? 442,000 for Trump, 129,000 for Haley. and 12,009 for DeSantis. And with Haley and DeSantis, when you look at the Georgia numbers, right? Whatever Haley got, DeSantis got 10% of that. The same thing in Washington State. Nikki Haley at 21.7%, Ron DeSantis at 2.2%. You know what I'm saying? So that's 10%. And the and Donald Trump at 74.2%. On the Democratic side, you got Joe Biden, 559,996. Right? So clearly, there was more Democratic participation. Let me see. Looking at the overall numbers. Yeah, because you had a total of 595,928 in the Republican primary. On the Democratic side, you had 645,907. But what you had in Washington State was you had 48,619 uncommitted. That's what we look at and been labeled as a protest vote, 7.5%. But in spite of that, from a percentage standpoint, with 79% of the votes counted, he got 86.7%. And Trump got 74.2% with Republicans. So, again, inner party data, apparently more Democrats who are participating in the process are voting for Biden than Republicans are voting for Trump. The issue is enthusiasm and turnout. But the bigger issue is going to be the independents. They're going to be the ones that are going to determine who the next president will be. All this Democratic stuff, this is pretty much, you know, I mean, all this primary stuff with the Democrats and Republicans, you know, that's just, I don't want to say it's window dressing, but, you know, this is just a, you know, folks exercising their support via the vote for their party candidate. But the real determining factor is going to be the independents and those who didn't commit to Trump and Biden during the primary process. Like yesterday, you had 645,807 folks participating in the Democratic primary, but you had 48,619 uncommitted. You got 19,883 for Dean Phillips. That's 3.1%. And Marianne Williamson got 17,309. That's another 2.7%. So you add that 37,192 votes between Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson, right? And add that that 37,000 to the 48,619. You're looking at 85,000 people who participated in the Democratic primary did not vote for Joe Biden. That's where, you know, and I learned this from Johnny Bumson back in the day, right? That's why the primary is important. It ain't just about winning the nomination. It's about you knowing where your support is and delegating resources. That's another dynamic that at this point, right, as relates to fundraising, you can't compare the two. For some reason, notwithstanding the fact that Sleepy Joe, like the Dokali, right? Dark Brandon, right? That's just the nicknames that we use on Twitter, right? As opposed to the Dokali Trump, right? The Tangerine Man, right? Or the Manchurian Cantaloupe, right? Okay, you know, he liked to wear makeup, right? And John Bolton, who was his foreign policy advisor, spill the beans, say, every day when he was president, it would take an hour and a half just to fix his makeup and all that stuff, right? the thing with them, right, is right now, for whatever reason, from a fundraising standpoint, Joe Biden lapping Donald Trump. And, you know, Trump is supposed to be a money man. Of course, you know, we're having some issues on legal side, but I'm talking about from a fundraising standpoint. And the Republican Party, historically, has always looked down on the Democratic Party, because the Republican Party, they're supposed to guard the rich, you know, corporate executives and all that stuff who like the tax breaks, and that's where they're going to send their money. You know what I mean? But for some reason, this year, like I was saying, St. Thomas, right? When it comes to raising money, right? Joe Biden is a boss, mister. You know, I don't know what it is, but he could raise money, mister. And people always say, you know, you look at the polls, right? And the polls right now showing Donald Trump winning by 2 points here, 3 points here, 1 point here. Ever so often you see an even or a Biden up by one. But they said the real poll ain't the percentage them that the pollsters telling you what the results be. The real polls is who sending in money and who raising money, right? And as it stands right now, if it's one thing that ain't even up for debate right about now, right? And I'm looking for the most recent data here, right? We're looking for February money. U.S. presidential. Hold on there. Election fundraising, right? And I want to get the February numbers because it came out last week. I think the number was 40. I know it was 40 million in January for the Biden-Harris team, and I think it was pretty much the same because it was a story that I saw. Okay, here we go. Right, it was a CNN story, right? And they said President Joe Biden raised at least $42 million for his reelection campaign at the Democratic Party in February. And they do a joint campaign thing there, right? Officials told CNN, a total fueled by the strongest month of grassroots donation during the election cycle, which campaign officials say demonstrates an underappreciated level of enthusiasm for the president, right? Biden campaign officials told CNN that last month's grassroots fundraising included nearly $2 million in grassroots donations on the final day of the month, February 29. That marked the campaign's second strongest grassroots fundraising day of the cycle so far, following the official launch of the Biden reelection campaign on April 25th of 2023. CNN was the first to report the figures. Now, of course, you can have all the money in the world. Don't mean you're going to win. You know what I'm saying? But what's interesting is this correlation between whenever you look at the polling data and they ask who does best with the economy, Trump wins by double digits. Yet for some reason as it relates to fundraising, Biden, and fundraising is money, Biden outraising the Republican. They said the Biden campaign had raised more than $42 million in January and had ended that month with $130 million on hand. So you add that 42, you add another 42 in February, that's 172. Of course, they're spending as they go. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this whole thing pans out because we got a number of variables going on. And of course, yesterday, the Robert Hur discussion was significant. So we'll take a break. When we come back, hopefully we could link up with the weather service and see what's going on. Be back right after this.
Bank of St. Croix has something for everyone. With two locations, the Bank of St. Croix provides personal and business checking accounts, online banking, and mobile apps for banking on the go, a nonprofit community investment checking account, and a 24-hour banking cash management platform. Bank of St. Croix, Gallows Bay, Bank of St. Croix, Peters Rest, and online, bankofstcroix.com. For details about our nonprofit community investment checking account, our service specialists are ready to help. Bank of St. Croix, member FDIC.
Sometimes you need a moment to just step back, relax, and listen to your favorite song. I'm Raina Duris, and on the next World Cafe, maybe I can help you find something new to love, or maybe remind you of something you've been missing. There's so much music out there to enjoy, so take a moment, take a breath, and tune in to World Cafe.
Weekdays at 10 p.m. on WTJX FM 93.1.
So I spent the past year trying to figure out what news designed for 21st century humans might look like. One of the things that really stuck with me was that we now know that humans actually need hope to get up in the morning. And I don't think as a journalist I ever thought about it that way.
We're always looking for new and better ways to understand the world we live in. That's On Point with me, Meghna Chakrabarty.
Weekdays at 1 p.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
Meet Rita Moreno.
I wanted to be a movie star from the time I saw my first picture.
Who found her good times only after some really difficult ones.
Be proud, you Puerto Rican. Be proud,
I was often treated like a sex object.
Enjoy Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony winner Rita Moreno, just a girl who decided to go for it.
Very early on, I realized that getting attention was a very nice thing.
On American Masters.
Tune in Friday, March 8th at 10 p.m. on WTJX TV, Channel 12.
And we're back here and analyze this. And I just reached out to one of my good counselor friends. I'm over in Iraq this time. He should be calling in on the line. Right now. And hopefully we could talk about a topic that was brought up by Senator Frankie Johnson when he was here. I don't know if it was last week or a week before. He said he was working on legislation, right, for the Speedy Trial Act. That was a couple of Fridays ago. Attorney Russell Pate is joining us from the Capitol, St. Thomas. Good morning, Counselor. How are you?
Good morning, Senator James. You know, I've been living on St. Croix since the pandemic, but I keep a low profile over with my little trees and orchard over here, my garden.
Oh, I like that. I like that. All is well?
I'm blessed, my friend. I'm blessed.
Okay, good thing. So, the Speedy Trial Act, right? We had Senator Franklin Johnson on a couple of Fridays back on March 1st, and he was working on some legislation to address that, right? And you and I were talking about that, and his thing was about an age component that he was looking at. I think his was 65 or whatever. Of course, you're in the realm. First of all, for those of us who are listening, because Senator Johnson and myself, we're not lawyers. You know, I might be a lawyer without portfolio, but you're a lawyer. So by definition, Speedy Trial Act means?
Generally, it's that a case gets to trial within a certain amount of time. Usually it's more focused on criminal cases than civil, because people who are arrested have a higher constitutional threshold for faster due process.
The difference between a local speedy trial statute and the federal speedy trial law. What would that be?
The sad state of affairs is, you know, words don't always mean what they say.
Mm-hmm.
So at the local level, we do not have a Speedy Trial Act for criminal cases. It's only embedded into what's called the common law, or kind of judicial decisions. And at the local level, I tell clients that even though they say they have this quote-unquote constitutional speedy trial right, you know, we're a territory. The Constitution doesn't really always extend to us, and it's much weaker, and that it's governed by the appellate courts. And I have not seen, really to date, people who've been in jail 4, 5, 6, 7 years waiting for trial. The courts have never said, oh, this is a violation. Dismiss this case and let the person free. that's usually for two reasons. Is judges are people too, and they live here. And if somebody's been charged with murder of, you know, a child or somebody else, the last thing the public wants to see is that the person is let out on a technicality. And so there's some resistance to that. At the federal level, it's even more disappointing. There is a statute that says, hey, you have to get the case to trial in a certain time, but the devil is in the details. And the details of the law are it can pretty much be manipulated by the U.S. Attorney's Office and the court that, it can be delayed so much. So you to get a speedy trial in the federal court, if you file any motions whatsoever, then your speedy trial is delayed. The prosecution will offer it sometimes deals to say, waive your speedy trial and we'll work more closely with you on some different issues. Or if they're getting close, if the government's getting close to having your case tried, but they don't feel like they're ready, they just amend the complaint against you and add like a new charge. And because there's a million jillion laws on the books, they can always find something else to charge you with. There's an old saying in Russian that Stalin, who was the terrible dictator, that he just says, show me a man and I'll tell you his crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because there's so many laws on the books, you can find something that you can always charge somebody with anything. So I found that even in the federal court, the Speedy Trial Act sounds great, but it's in practice, it's hard to implement.
No,
but we can talk about different things too. On, you know, it goes beyond the court. It's structural. It's not just you can say a sheet of paper and that the judges can do that. The changes have to start at a structural level, and there's various reasons why the courts are slow in the Virgin Islands that go across a bunch of different areas.
Okay, good. We're joined by Hannibal O'Brien on the other line. Good morning, Counselor. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? Good morning to your listening audience and your guests.
Yeah, well, Tuayo had do it was not a tag team. It was a joint appearance last year, so I'm glad to have both of you back on again. I think it was around 4th of July weekend, so I'm glad to have you on. We're talking about the speedy trial statutes, Attorney O'Brien, and by definition, right, the Speedy Trial Act provides that the trial of a defendant charged with an offense against the United States shall be commenced within 60 days from the date the defendant is arrested or a summons is issued. You've worked for many a years in the public defender's office, and Attorney Pate was saying we don't have a local speedy trial statute, Attorney O'Brien, here in the Virgin Islands.
No,
we do. We don't.
No, we don't. That's on the federal level, but there's structural differences that make it such that that the federal government can do that. It has more to do with how cases are brought in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
On the federal level, they generally investigate, get their ducks in a row, so by the time they arrest you, you know, it's a very short period of time where you get your discovery and the process starts moving. Whereas on the local level, a lot of the times investigations are done after they establish probable cause. So they're still investigating while they're waiting for you to, you know, while you're waiting for your day in court.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, so that slows down the process.
No, hold on 1 second. Attorney Pate, you mentioned that a defense attorney can file a motion and that impacts the clock, right? Is that what you're saying?
I hate to be devil's in the detail. We're talking about the federal court now.
The federal court, court, yeah.
Right, there's no speedy trial act in local court. But in federal court, yes, you file a motion, it will impact the speedy trial.
So that's basically what's going on right now with Trump, because back in June of last year when Jack Smith first filed the classified documents, charges and the indictment, he said he will seek a speedy trial or whatever it was, right? And what we've seen is a lot of motions since then. Obviously, you know, he wanted a date as soon as possible, and now we're like, what, 9 months since then. But is that an example of what you're talking about?
Exactly. And you have to realize now that in this modern age, lawyers are not trial lawyers, really. Lawyers are motion lawyers.
Okay.
We 90% of the work, maybe 95% of the work you do on the civil side is sheets of paper filing back and forth to change the case and bend it and turn it and what law is applied and what evidence can be in the trial. On the criminal side, and Hannibal O'Brien, the great counselor there, can help, but there's still motion practice in criminal cases. It may not be 90% or 95, but it can be 50% of the case before you get to trial. So I'll turn that over to Hannibal.
Hannibal, what's your perspective on that?
Well, see, that is exactly right. A public defender's office will file a bunch of motions where appropriate to protect all of the rights of my client, you know, but we have an eye on the day that eventually we go into court and we actually try the matter. You know, and in the civil side, usually cases take a much longer period of time because there's a lot more paper that is going back and forth between the two sides.
Let me ask this question as face from a lay people perspective. If you're a defense attorney, criminal case, and you got bulletproof defense, does a speedy trial work in your favor all the time?
Well, see, when you say bulletproof defense, you mean something that unequivocally...
You know what they charge. What they charge Neville James for? Neville James ain't being there, and you ready to go ASAP?
Well, what I would do is, you know, that which I purported to be evidence that substantiates what you just said, I would have communicated that to the prosecuting attorney, hoping that they will exercise their ethical obligation
and drop the charge.
You know, and dismiss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, they listen.
But what about, now hold on a second. What about instances, and this is for both of you, what about instances when you have zealous prosecutors who look into make their name, because those type of guys exist. You know what I'm saying? What about ladies? What about that instance? Even if you know that they know, right? Because that's how human relationships are, right? You know they know the case ain't anywhere as strong as they present, they purporting it to be, but they still want to go to trial.
No, well, you have some individuals like that, but, you know, there are ethics that both sides have got to adhere to,
right?
And there's prosecutorial ethics.
Mm-hmm.
It is actually unethical for them to bring a case where they know unequivocally that they don't have the goods. Now, of course, there's degrees of not having the goods. There's some lawyers that will look and say, okay, there's if it's 50-50, I'm not going to bring the case. And it depends on the volume. It depends on the disposition of the head of the office, etc. Then there are some individuals that say, well, even though 50-50, I'm going to bring the case anyway.
Yeah.
That's
the instance I'm talking about. I'm not saying they're bad lawyers. I'm just saying they're willing to take risk, even though the percentages might not be in their favor.
Right. And, you know, and there's also the fact that there are a number of, and I don't mind saying that there are a number of locations where individuals are trying cases because they're looking for the experience. They're not necessarily thinking in terms of whether or not justice be done. You know, but again, they have to be ready to defend their decisions from an ethical point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to ask this question in the context of the federal speedy trial. And let me go back to Attorney Pete. This law has been on the books for this year's going to make 50 years. Why haven't we had a local speedy trial statute? Why do you think? Because it's not you for you to say, because you've never been an elected official, what have you. But 50 years is a long time for a federal statute to be in place, and we don't have a local statute. Why do you think that's the case?
I'm going to try to make this as simple as possible.
Mm-hmm.
First, 50 years, we've not had a local territorial court that tried a volume of criminal cases for 50 years. You have to realize that we're a product of the federal court. We're a territory. Our local courts, the territorial courts that came out in the territorial and superior court, those really started being created in the 90s. So, I mean, that's still 30-plus years.
Yeah.
So we're not quite at 50. But just in a brief, I have to give some legal history, but in brief, most judges in the United States in state courts, they issue rulings from the bench. So this is why it's structural. So if you go to court, where I practice in North Carolina and Texas, you're going to be in the courtroom and you're going to be making your motion arguments to the judge that you filed, you know, a month ago. And you actually, the judges in the states will say, every first Tuesday or every first Monday of the month, come into my court. I've got the whole day, and we go through your motions, and I rule from the bench. I don't write up a 50-page order. I say who I think won and a little brief thing about why, and the court reporter writes it down, and you can order the transcript if you want to appeal later. And that's one of the problems in the Virgin Islands is, our system grew out of the federal court. That's what all the attorneys were watching. That's what all the attorneys that went to be judges, they saw the federal judge. And when a federal judge has two kids from law school, I call them kids now, but they'll have two kids that graduated law school, and they're now the law clerks for the judge. And that judge asked them to, you know, write up drafts of their rulings. And those can be, you know, 5 pages to 100 pages. And they issue these fancy rulings that are published in the books and online about all the legal issues. And so when we had the territorial court started, it started that way, where the first territorial judges were like, hey, I need law clerks. And so we're one of the few jurisdictions that our judges have two law clerks out of law school, and they're paid. Where if you're in Texas or North Carolina or many other states, you're just a judge. You have your secretary. You don't have a law clerk.
Wow.
And you don't write up these big opinions. You don't even publish them. They're not published. It's only the appellate courts that do. So that's one stumbling block on speed, is that you go, and I'll give one example here.
We're going to take a break. Don't hang up, because I know I asked you to stay on for a segment. If I could hold you on for 5 minutes after we come back, I'd appreciate that. So I give you a chance to give that example, okay?
Sure.
We got Attorney Russell Pete and Attorney Hannibal O'Brien here talking about the Speedy Trial Act, which was enacted in 1974. And then there was an amendment in 79, right, as well, which, hold on there, in order to ensure that defendants are not rushed to trial without an adequate opportunity to prepare, Congress amended the Act in 1979 to provide a minimum time period during which trial may not commence. So it was a continuing legislation as well. So we'll take a break, be back right after that, and get some more details from Attorney O'Brien and Attorney Pate.
UVI's annual fundraiser, Afternoon on the Green, is back on Sunday, March 17th from noon to 5 p.m. on the UVI Golf Course on St. Thomas. Enjoy mouthwatering dishes, music by RVP Band and Shaw HP, plus face painting and bouncy houses for the kids. Register online for the best dress and hat competition. Visit aog.uvi.edu. Sponsored by VIA, VI Council on the Arts, Hogland VI, and First Bank.
There are many complex issues that arise in our territory.
Comes with the Territory with Leslie Comision.
Join me, Leslie Comision, for a breakdown of political issues facing our territory, one conversation at a time.
I'm here to be the voice you can rely on for information that is straightforward and comprehensive. Tune in to be a part of the discussion. It all comes with the territory.
Comes with the Territory airs Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airs at 7 p.m. on WTJX TV, Channel 12.
As the news gets more complex and changes through the day, you need more than just a quick headline check. Here and Now keeps you connected to your world between Morning Edition and All Things Considered, as the news and the people shaping it are changing in real time. I'm Robin Young. Follow along on Here and Now, NPR News weekday afternoons.
From 2 to 4 on WTJX-FM, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
Hi, I'm Peter Sagal. You spent the week listening to the news. Don't you think you deserve to show off what you've learned on Wait, we give you a chance to impress your friends with your knowledge of international incidents, political gaffes, and the latest advancement in German nudists. You'll be the life of the party or the death. Either way, you'll make an impression and you can thank Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. right here on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
And we're back here on Analyze This, and joined by two of our distinguished counselors here in the Virgin Islands, Attorney Russell Pate, out of the rack, but actually look like he fell in love with St. Croix in the older age, and Hannibal O'Brien from out of the West, but also out of the Bronx, right? Right, Hannibal? The Bronx? Yes. So we're talking about the Speedy Trial Act, Senator Franklin Johnson. Is looking at legislation that we could probably adopt in the 35th legislature. First of all, thank you, gentlemen, for on short notice for joining me this morning. I appreciate it. Mr. Pate, go ahead, Annabelle, and then Mr. Pate could give us the example.
Okay, the only thing I was going to say is that one of the things is that, you know, you have the indictment system on the federal level.
Yeah.
And because of the indictment system, they're presenting evidence, which is indicative of having already gathered the evidence necessary in order to prosecute. But that's different from the way in which we establish probable cause. We just have an initial hearing where where there's an affidavit written up, and that's how the cases begin in the local court. So, there are some built-in things that are going to slow things down anyway. But, you know, it's a good idea because within that idea, then the defense attorney will know, okay, at a certain period of time, I could file this motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute, and we get on with it. On the other hand, what about a circumstance where there's evidence that it takes us a little bit more time to get from a defense point of view? Should the defendant be penalized because of the fact that he can't get it within a certain period of time?
That's a legitimate question. Have either of you ever, gentlemen, ever worked on the prosecutor side?
No.
I can't.
No.
So because I want to ask this question, are prosecutors obligated to show their entire hand during the indictment phase, or is it likely that they're going to show just enough to get the charge in place, and then later on bring additional evidence that could be even more damning? Historically. You're jarbled, Hannibal. For some reason, you're coming too clear.
I'll take over, Hannibal, while you get your go ahead. Better. Senator James, the indictment phase, there's a discovery phase after the indictment is filed. then the prosecution is to turn over all of their files, all their evidence.
Okay.
And then a certain case law called Brady and Giglio, which means they have to turn over even evidence that could maybe be helpful or exculpatory. So no, the defendant is not present for the information or the indictment. It's kind of a one-sided process. And then when the defendant is brought into that and arraigned, then starts your trial scheduling, where you turn over all of the files and the discovery to the counsel for the defendant.
Okay, so all the files are not necessary at the indictment phase.
No,
but during the discovery phase and as we proceed to trial, you can't present any evidence at trial that you hadn't made available to the defense.
That's somewhat true. There can be some things that are what they call opening the door at trial.
Okay.
And you've opened the door into an area that the other side can rebut. But okay. Generally, a trial in civil and criminal, there should never be a surprise, particularly on the civil side. The civil side, you can take depositions. There's no right to being silent. A judge in a civil case should never be surprised at the evidence that's coming out. It should have been all talked about in the motions and everything else. It's just having six people on the jury decide, oh, this person's lying or not. They're doing a credibility determination on who has the more probable case.
Okay, good. Hannibal, you back on yet? For some reason, you're still breaking up and still jarbled. I don't know what happened.
We'll have them call back in.
Yeah. Hang up on Carla and Hannibal. And see if that works. Let me ask this question. One of the things that we're learning with a lot of these high-profile Trump cases, Attorney Pate, is the motions dynamic, right? Because a lot of people are of the belief it's a very straightforward deal. Charges are filed against somebody. There's discovery, and then we go to trial. But we're learning that the motions aspect is clearly a tactic of President Trump is to delay, because there's an election pending and all that stuff. Talk about the importance of why counsel has to be on top of things and effectively use the motions dynamic in defending their client after charge.
Okay, I'm back.
Okay, good. Yeah, I asked a question with respect to lay people, lay folk like ourselves, knowing about discovery, knowing about somebody getting charged, and knowing about discovery, waiting for trial waiting for the case to go to trial. But in this case, we're learning a lot with these high-profile cases with Trump.
Yep.
That the motions dynamic is very, 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 very important and actually high impact as it relates to time. I want both of your perspective on that.
Well, the motions are necessary in order to what they call preserve the issues. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times, these issues are not going to be resolved on the lower court level. The judges, you know, might say, yeah, but notwithstanding. And then there's the issue of prejudice. Then there's a lot of other issues that the judge needs to consider. And we go to trial. And the reason that's important is because of the fact that unless it's a constitutional issue, if you don't raise it on the lower level by motion, it's considered waived.
Yes.
Wow. So that's why they do it. And I apologize to your listening audience because I'm at the St. Thomas Airport and I'm competing with all of the construction that's going on.
No, that's okay. Don't worry about that. We're good. I got you on short notice anyway. Your perspective, Attorney Pate, on why the motions phase is not well known, but highly important.
Well, yes. So let's put an example this way. My work is civil cases. So
yeah.
I do work against the refinery and the bauxite plant and tobacco companies. So those companies have billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in court and it's mano a mano, there's only one lawyer when you watch them on TV that questions and one lawyer that says objection. But when you're sitting in your office, and let's say that the lawyers for the oil companies or tobacco companies, they have 50 lawyers on their side. Tell me how many motions can they create? Hundreds.
Right.
And so if you have one judge and you're trying to get your case to trial, And this could be just like Trump. He's going to have, you know, a huge bench of lawyers. You read about the top lawyer, but that lawyer is going to have 30 lawyers under him doing motions. The motions are to confine the evidence for trial. So Trump is going to say, well, I'm immune. You can't put on this evidence for these crimes because I'm immune for those. But it goes even further. Let's say, you know, on a criminal side, if Senator Neville James is arrested, let's say you're driving your car and they pull you over because they smelled marijuana, and then they searched your car and they found $50,000 of cash in there. Now, you may have a perfectly legitimate reason for that $50,000 of cash. You had just sold, you know, a little piece of land to a farmer, and he gave you $50,000 of cash, and you're driving it to the bank. But they want to take you to trial anyway on that. And so your attorney files a motion saying, wait a second, this isn't a legal arrest. Because Senator James was driving in the speed limit. There's nothing that he did wrong. They smelled marijuana. Yet under our new law, the smoking marijuana is not illegal anymore. So they have now arrested him for something that's not illegal, mm-hmm. to then charge him for having money. So that one motion could have your whole case thrown out, so you don't have to face the risk of going to trial, being convicted, and then essentially, you know, being in jail until there's an appeal.
Wow.
So that's why motion practice is so important. And on the civil side, you know, it's such small issues that you can fight about. Let's say I have a client that's hurt. I'm about to go to trial. This is a great client. But the other side says, well, at trial, we want to bring in evidence of that he has a gay boyfriend. And you say, well, that's not relevant. You know, being gay is not illegal. But you're like, well, we know that there's some people on the jury that might be very religious, and they're going to hold that against your client. So we want to get that in. And, you know, that's not relevant to whether the person was hurt or injured, but that's things that you fight about over a motion practice to make sure that the other attorney doesn't come into court and let that slip just to prejudice the jury.
Wow.
So those are things that motion practice cleans up.
Those are excellent examples. Now, let me ask this question from a prosecutorial standpoint. If the defense knows your tactics, which is you're in the delay business, how can a prosecutor, and I'll start with you, Hannibal, call your bluff and say, look, I'm ready to go to trial now?
Well, that's not a bluff on me, because you got to remember that the only person with a burden is the prosecutor.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so if the prosecutor says, I got all the evidence I need, I'm ready to go to trial now, let it go with it, let it continue with the motion, and at some point I'm going to ask the judge, wait a minute, how long this thing going to happen?
Well, you know, well, they do it all the time. But the judge must make a ruling if I have made a motion in a timely fashion.
Because I'm going to give you a perfect example. The Bragg case that's supposed to go to trial on the 25th of this month, right? Apparently now, on Monday, either Monday or yesterday, Trump said, well, I don't think this should go to trial because the immunity case isn't being heard before the Supreme Court until April 22nd. And I believe they're going to use some evidence that overlaps into when, because, you know, of course, this trial in Manhattan is about the hush money pre-election, right? And their argument now is, well, I believe they're going to use some evidence from 2018 when I was the president. And the judge is saying, now, why you wait now to come with this type of thing? Because the judge literally asked that. I read that today.
First of all, a judge generally issues what's known as a scheduling order.
Scheduling order. Okay, good. Yeah,
and he usually has in there a time which all motions should be filed to be considered timely.
Mm-hmm.
See, so the judge does have a certain amount of discretion to say, "Oh no, I gave you knew this motion was being filed in some other case, you know, and you didn't bring this immunity thing at the time, you know, here, but now you're telling me that it's going to have an effect on this case." Well, the truth of the matter is that the status quo is what's in effect until the Supreme Court rules. So
okay.
There's nothing that says, oh, wait a minute, we're going to halt all proceedings that have a potential impact by the Supreme Court's ruling because of the fact that it makes it sensible to do that. No, that would slow down the entire court system. So a good judge would go, oh, really? Okay, well, we're going to trial. That's not going to affect my court.
No, because the judge said defendant does not explain the reason for the late filing.
Exactly.
For a mere 2.5 weeks before jury selection is set to begin. Effective immediately, the parties are hereby directed to obtain leave of the court before filing any additional motions prior to March 25th, 2024. The judge is saying what in laypeople language?
What he's saying is, I tell you when you're supposed to have filed these motions, and you're filing these motions out of time.
Yeah.
So why are you dealing with, and there's a concept called excusable neglect.
Mm-hmm.
That's a standard that a movement has to reach to say why he didn't do something within a period of time that he was supposed to do, mm-hmm. or she was supposed to have done.
Yeah, I just write down that term, so I'm going to do my homework now. So quickly, gentlemen, we got a minute left. I want to ask both of you, is a local speedy trial statute in the best interest of the Virgin Islands? Yes or no?
You want me to go first, Hannibal? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
it's a double-edged sword. It's a double-edged sword.
You sound like why I was for 12 years a politician, man. I like that. Go ahead, Hannibal, quick.
It could result in a whole lot of individuals being structurally exonerated for things that they actually did.
That's a good point. Attorney Pate, your take, 30 seconds.
I'd say no. It's the problem is structurally we can't do it. That would then knock our civil cases are already 5-10 years behind. That would knock all the civil cases. We just need changes structurally. The judges call balls and strikes. They make oral rulings from the bench. You divide the civil and criminal judges 2-2, so the criminal cases can have 2 experienced judges, the civil through 2 judges, and you set up motion hearings on the Monday or Tuesday of the first of the month. It's structural changes, not a bill that says do this as a mandate.
I'll reach out to the good senator out of the West and let him know maybe we need to look at the structural change approach as opposed to a local speedy trial statute. Attorney Hannibal O'Brien out of the West and Mr. Aruba and Texas, Russell Pate, glad to have you on this morning. Thank you very much for filling in on short notice. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. Have a nice day.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate that. And we're very fortunate to get these 2 distinguished counselors. Hey, great show today, man. Thank you, Dr. Tull. Thank you to the audience. Be good and be safe. Tomorrow, Malik Siku from 8:20 to 10 o'clock. Look out for that. And it's going to be a live stream too. So look out for that as well. Okay? Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect those of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
Once the highest paid actress in America.
Goodness, what beautiful diamond. Goodness has nothing to do with it, dearie.
Meet writer-producer seductress Mae West. She was a girl who lost her reputation.
Bad girl.
You find out.
And never missed it.
I'm no angel.
The glamour of 1930s Hollywood depended a lot on Mae West.
You mustn't see me like that.
Come here and see Mae West, Dirty Blonde.
Are you in town for good?
I expect to be here, but not for good.
On American Masters.
Tune in March 11th at 10 p.m. on WTJX TV Channel 12.
He said that black smoke was constantly coming out of the burn pits 24/7. And my reaction to it was like, wow, that doesn't sound very safe. I wonder what that's about. And in my mind, I couldn't imagine at the time that type of system operating could potentially harm our service members.
Journalism that seeks and reveals. That's On Point with me, Meghna Chakrabarty.
Weekdays at 1 p.m. on WTJX FM 93.1, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.